States Democrat Joe Biden captured the U.S. presidency on Saturday, becoming the 46th president of the United States. Major news organizations began reporting this just minutes ago. Biden supporters narrowly rebuffed Republican incumbent Donald Trump and embraced Biden's promise to fight the coronavirus pandemic and fix the economy in this divided nation. Mr. Biden is planning for a possible primetime speech on Saturday, as his lead over Republican President Donald Trump continues to expand. He had scheduled a primetime address on Friday night, but several battleground states remain too close to call at that time. Again, we'll have continued coverage of this story throughout the day. In other news, here are some of the latest developments in the coronavirus crisis. The virus has claimed over 1.2 million lives worldwide since it first emerged in China late last year. That's according to Johns Hopkins University, and more than 49 million cases have been reported. The United States remains the most affected country with over 236,000 deaths. The countries with the next highest death tolls are Brazil with more than 162,000 deaths, India with over 125,000 deaths, and Mexico with over 94,000 deaths. In the United States, Joe Biden said that his administration would, on day one, put a plan in action to control the virus. More than 127,000 new infections are being reported in the U.S., the third straight day of record cases. U.S. President Donald Trump's chief of staff, meanwhile, Mark Meadows, has tested positive for COVID-19, U.S. media is reporting. For more on these and other stories, please visit our website at voanews.com for continued coverage of the election. This is VOA News. A jailed human rights lawyer in Iran, Nazreen Satoudeh, has been granted temporary release, the Iranian Judiciary's news website reported on Saturday. The UN had called on Iran to free her, as well as other political prisoners excluded from a push to empty jails amid the coronavirus pandemic. In August, she announced she was going on a hunger strike to demand the release of political prisoners and focus attention on their plight due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But health issues prompted the 57-year-old to stop the strike roughly 45 days after she started it, her husband said in September. Satoudeh was sentenced in 2019 to serve 12 years in jail for defending women arrested for protesting compulsory headscarf laws in the Islamic Republic, a system of temporary releases to reduce the populations in severely overcrowded prisons, has benefited some 120,000 inmates. It was introduced in Iran in February to rein in transmission of COVID-19. The European Union and Britain said on Saturday that major differences remain in their Brexit talks, but that negotiations would continue next week to try to clinch a trade deal in the little time left. European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen said after a phone call with Prime Minister Boris Johnson that the differences were large, and Johnson described them as significant. Despite multiple rounds of talks, including 2 weeks of intense meetings that ended Wednesday, the two leaders said they remained apart on key issues, including fisheries and mechanisms to guarantee fair competition between British and European companies. Johnson said the negotiating teams would reconvene in London on Monday in order to redouble efforts to reach a deal. Both leaders said they had agreed to remain in personal contact as well, signaling a stepped-up political effort to secure a new trading partnership before Britain ends a post-Brexit transition period on December 31st. President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree ordering the Russian government to work towards meeting the 2015 Paris Agreement to fight climate change, but stressed any action must be balanced with the need to ensure strong economic development. Russia is the world's fourth largest emitter of greenhouse gases. It had previously signaled its acceptance of the accord, even as environmentalists have criticized Moscow for shunning compulsory emission targets for companies backed with fines. Putin formally ordered the government to work towards a cut in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 of up to 30% below the emission levels in 1990. Be remote. Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Usually we analyze and discuss various issues all around the world on this program, but this week, just about everywhere on this earth, people are wondering, who will be president of the United States as of January? Will there be a change? Did Donald Trump lose the election this past Tuesday? Let's turn to our panelists, who, like all journalists here in Washington, D.C., are operating on limited sleep. It's not absolutely certain that Joe Biden, the former vice president, the Democrat, has been elected president. Not absolutely certain whether President Trump won or lost. There was word of lawsuits that are already being filed. Emily Tamkin, from the moment that the polling places closed on Tuesday night, Mr. Trump was in a mood to fight. What did you see?
It wasn't just after the polling places closed. I mean, the president had been saying for weeks that he had doubts as to the legitimacy of the election. He said that mail-in voting was fraudulent, which is not true. Yeah, I mean, President Trump very early Wednesday morning got out and declared victory, although that was premature. On Wednesday, he declared victory in Pennsylvania and in Michigan, although he had not won those states, and indeed Michigan is projected for Joe Biden. Sort of parallel to this declaration of victory, yes, he's either threatening or going in with lawsuits across the country, either to stop the counting of votes or to say that ballots accepted after Election Day, you know, for example, in Pennsylvania, that were postmarked on or before Election Day but arrived after are not legitimate and get thrown out. So I think what we should expect is that even if in the next few days or even today, there's a projection of a Biden victory, we should still expect President Trump to try to take the case to the Supreme Court, as he has said, to take a case to the Supreme Court, as he has said he wants to do, although it should be noted that Bush v. Gore in 2000, that was a specific case in Florida that then made its way up to the Supreme Court, right? You can't just say that I want this to be decided by the Supreme Court. So we should expect, in addition to, you know, hours and days of nail biting and results watching, we should expect more threats of and acts of litigation from the president.
You know, the weekend before Election Day, President Trump was out there in the key states considered battlegrounds with large outdoor rallies, not taking many protective measures against the coronavirus. And the crowds really turned out. One of the things that President Trump told them was the only way he could lose the election is if the other side, the Democrats, would be cheating. And so in a way, Josh Glancy, President Trump continued with that narrative. Even at the White House, hours after polls closed, that speech he gave to supporters at 2:30 a.m. Wednesday, our time, where he said the voting must stop. In effect, he was saying the vote counting must stop in some states. He was claiming some form of fraud, Josh.
Yeah, certainly the president has primed his supporters for this moment. But in a funny way, he also telegraphed it. And he also made it rather predictable. You know, I think we all knew he was going to make this speech. And so therefore, in a way, it almost felt quite performative. And I think the Democrats on the other side did a very effective message about also preparing people for this moment, preparing people for the fact that it might take a long time to count the ballots, that there was likely to be what they call a blue shift, so that it would look like Trump was ahead. But actually, once all the mail-in ballots were counted, the Democrats would take the lead because Democrat ballots, they'd do better in the mail-in voting. So I think the messaging on this has been quite effective. So although we are obviously in a very febrile moment as we record this, and we don't know how it's going to turn out, and there could yet be Supreme Court battles and street battles for that matter. But I think so far, for all the sound and fury, things have proceeded somewhat as expected and with relatively little serious discord and unrest. But that could obviously change. And the longer this goes on, the more fraught it becomes, really.
We did hear from the various states that the officials who are in charge of counting the votes were just doing their job. Yes, they had to cope with more votes than ever. And in a moment, we'll talk about the high voter turnout and what that means. But because of COVID-19, the coronavirus, a huge number of Americans decided to vote in advance using absentee ballots or mail-in ballots, literally mailing them in. and there was some concern as to whether the U.S. Postal Service was delivering them promptly, or a lot of people were delivering their ballots to local offices or official drop boxes. But still, there were more pieces of paper that had to be opened and then analyzed and counted. And it simply took time. The state officials were putting out the message, don't worry about it. And as for Joe Biden, the former vice president, his message, not just to his supporters, but he said to all Americans, was let all the votes be counted. Biden did say from early in the process on Wednesday that Biden believed he would be the winner. So, Emily, it seemed that Biden didn't want to sound boastful. He was handling an apparent victory with some modesty and again, advocating patience.
Yeah, I think if your message is you have to wait for every vote to be counted, you can't then declare victory prematurely. So I think that he was trying to say that we believe that we are on track to win, but you need to keep counting the votes. And I mean, first of all, in some of these places, state officials couldn't begin counting the votes until election day, which is why people were saying, well, if Biden wins Florida and Texas, then we can probably know night of. But if not, if it goes to the Rust Belt states, which indeed it did, you know, the Pennsylvania, your Michigan, your Wisconsin, the state legislature in Pennsylvania said, no, you can't start counting votes before election day. So then you necessarily are going to need to keep counting them after election day in an election, which exactly as you said, has unprecedented early voting and mail-in voting. And I would also say that continuing to count, that's not a partisan issue, right? We're seeing it now in, you know, you had Trump supporters in Michigan chanting, stop the vote, and in Arizona saying, keep counting. Well, every vote deserves to be counted, right? Democrats and Republicans and independents all cast their votes with the expectation that that vote will be counted.
Josh, when you see that the vote count was a slow process and that some Americans were patient with it, but in this day of fast-moving media and online social networking, if it takes a lot of time, that lends itself to all sorts of conspiracy theories. I don't just call it impatience. It's almost dangerous, but I suppose it's unavoidable.
Yes. Clearly, the longer it goes on, the more we can fill in the blanks and people who are inclined to believe conspiracy theories about the election. And there have been these theories going around online, and we saw them translate into real life. People turned up at a Detroit counting center to protest the count there. But what we haven't seen are these armed gangs. We haven't seen rioting. We haven't really seen clashes between people and the authorities in any significant way. So, yeah, it's a very, very fraught moment. And the longer it goes on, the worse it'll probably get. And we have to hope for a quick and clean denouement at some point. But at the moment, I would say the system is creaking, but not collapsing, which is a reassurance of sorts.
And we noticed another adjective from you, Josh, febrile, right? Everything at a high fever. Well, sure, but some people were watching calmly, even as there were states where, well, as of Thursday, for instance, about 2 days after the voting stopped, they were too close to call. North Carolina, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Arizona, Michigan and Wisconsin were very important states. They were won by Donald Trump 4 years ago. This time, Joe Biden was declared to be the winner in both Michigan and Wisconsin. And that was a key to Biden's hopes that he would indeed be the eventual winner. But bottom line, the fact that it's so close in these 51 separate elections, the 50 states, and here in Washington, D.C., in almost every state except for Maine and Nebraska, it's winner take all. You could win the state by one vote and you would get all the electoral college votes from that state. So like 51 separate elections, very close. And that means that America is very divided, almost 50-50. Emily, what's your take on that?
I think regardless of who the outcome of this election is declared to be, millions of people, tens of millions of people are going to be disappointed and angry. And if indeed Joe Biden is declared to be the winner, there's been a lot of punditry that's like, well, Trump wasn't repudiated and Trumpism will continue. Yes, of course, because there are indeed tens of millions of people in the United States across the country who voted for Donald Trump to have a second term, who will maybe believe that this election was stolen from him because of what the president has said, and who will continue with Trump's politics and take that forward. That's not going away, even if Joe Biden is indeed in the White House. I think there are some people particularly outside of the United States, maybe, who thought that nobody would vote for Trump a second time. But that's not the reality of the United States. There, you know, 60-something million people did indeed vote for Donald Trump.
Well, let's think about the two coasts that are considered to be liberal, right? On the West Coast, the states of California, which is huge, Oregon and Washington, they went for Joe Biden big, you know, almost 2-1 in California. And on the East Coast in the Northeast, again, liberal states like New York and New Jersey and up into New England, states like Vermont, New Hampshire, Connecticut, they're so big for Joe Biden and the Democrats. But in the middle of the country, all those states that are pro-Donald Trump, that are conservative states, Trump held on to the vast majority of states and voters that he had won 4 years ago. So Josh, say something, if you would, about almost the expectation on the West Coast and the East Coast that Americans would reject Donald Trump. And it tells me that people who live on the coasts don't understand the middle of the country.
And vice versa. You know, it's important to remember that there's plenty of people in the middle who don't really understand the coast. Yes, I think a lot of liberals and Democrats, particularly looking at the polling in advance of the election, which favored Biden very heavily, were hoping that this would be a blowout. And one thing we do know for certain at this point is that it is not a blowout. Biden does seem to have won the popular vote very comfortably, but that's not how this election is decided. The fact that we're still counting and it's razor thin in Georgia, in Arizona, and seemingly in Pennsylvania, although there's a lot of vote left to count there, shows us that, yes, this was a very tight election. And Trump was able to turn out one of the high, you know, he turned out more voters than any, I think this is correct, than any president in history, more than Obama in 08. It's just Biden seems to have even more at the moment. So Donald Trump is a very popular politician, and people really listened to what he was saying, and it really resonated. And his hectic rally schedule in the last few weeks really whipped up a lot of support in the swing states. People turned out for him, and their concerns will have to be addressed. And that's primarily an issue for the Republican Party if Donald Trump loses. They need to find a way to address the concerns and ideas that he's promoted and find a candidate who can reflect that but isn't Donald Trump. That's if he loses. So yeah, there's no great repudiation of Trump or Trumpism, but we'll see how it turns out.
As for the high turnout, indeed, as of Thursday, add up all the numbers from all the states, and Donald Trump had about 68.5 million votes. Indeed, more than anyone got in the past. 68.5 million, but Joe Biden had just over 72 million votes. But it's not the popular votes that decide things. What's going to happen with the new Congress in the new year when we come back?
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. And our moderator, Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
How about the American Congress? Not much change is expected as the votes were being counted. Democrats before this election had 47 seats in the Senate, 47 seats out of 100. The Democrats wanted to win in several states where Republicans held seats that seemed vulnerable. Democrats needed 3 to get to 50 Senate seats, exactly half, or a net gain of 4 seats to have 51, but they appear to have fallen short. Emily, what do you make of that?
While it looks likely that Democrats will keep the House, it does not at present look like they're going to retake the Senate, although it is possible that both Senate seats in Georgia will go to a runoff election in January. So if you have enjoyed watching Georgia nervously this week, I have great news for you. Yeah, I think to me personally, this was more surprising than how close the presidential election was, right? I think that we had good reason to expect the presidential election to be very close for all the reasons that we've described already. But Republican senators who were expected by everyone to lose their seats, Susan Collins in Maine and Tom Tillis in North Carolina, Sarah Gideon has already conceded to Susan Collins in Maine. You know, it's possible that Democratic challenger Cal Cottingham will still pull through in North Carolina, but it seems likely, as I'm saying this, that Tom Tillis will return to the U.S. Senate. So I think in down ballot races, the Democratic Party will have some soul searching to do. You know, is it failing to connect with, for example, rural voters? Well, why is that? Did the decision to limit door knocking because we're in a pandemic, how much did that hurt Democrats? You know, there were reports that despite the kind of top of the tickets instructions not to do door knocking, that Ilhan Omar in Minnesota and Rashida Tlaib in Michigan, for example, continued to go door by door and get out the vote. And after the dust settles and everyone takes stock, will people say, oh, yes, that was really important. That ended up helping us in Minnesota and Michigan. Is that what hurt us in Texas, where, for example, Democrats were very optimistic that this would be the time that they would start, you know, if not turning Texas blue, then turning it more blue than it currently is. And they were not able to do that. So even if Joe Biden does end up in the White House, the Democratic Party did not perform as well as they had hoped and as many had expected them to in down ballot races.
So as we discussed, the Democrats had hoped to capture a majority in the U.S. Senate, but they appear to have fallen short. The Republicans appear very likely to hold the control of the Senate. And many political pundits say that means the Republicans will be able to restrict what a President Joe Biden will be able to do, some of his more progressive or liberal ideas, whether that's on the environment or rolling back the so-called Trump tax cut from the year 2017 and increasing the taxes on American corporations. Maybe Joe Biden would not be able to do that, even if he's president, because the Senate would be held by pro-business Republicans. As for the House of Representatives, the Democrats, it appears, will hold their majority, but they actually lost a few seats. So there certainly is not a so-called blue wave. Blue is the color of the Democratic Party here. Not a blue wave, Josh. So indeed, there are lessons to be learned. Republicanism and Trumpism were not soundly rejected.
No, and the congressional results for the House of Representatives are pretty disappointing if you're a Democrat. There will be questions asked of their leader, Nancy Pelosi, who's currently the Speaker of the House, as to why they seem to struggle. They seem to have done quite badly among Hispanic voters in America, particularly. And the Senate results are disappointing too. I think Joe Biden didn't have a lot of what they call coattails, which in American politics means he didn't bring a lot of down ballot candidates with him. People voted for Joe Biden primarily because they wanted to see the end of the Trump presidency, but he wasn't a candidate who greatly excited the base or created a real sense of a movement behind him. And so he doesn't seem to have helped particularly other candidates in the Democratic Party do well. And it's the first time that a Democrat is taking the control of the presidency, if he wins, to not have the Senate for, I think, since 1988. So it's going to be a pretty tough time for him. All his transformative ideas are basically out the window if he becomes president, because Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, will be very, very tough. We know he's a very tough operator, and he won't really let him do much at all that isn't pretty moderate. So both from his cabinet appointees to his legislative plans, to his judicial appointees, everything will have to be neutral, not neutral, but everything will have to be moderate and done with the cooperation of the Republicans. So there is a little bit of glumness in some Democratic circles that even if they win the presidency, they're not going to be able to enact the kind of transformative agenda that they think the country needs.
You're describing, Josh, political friction likely between Joe Biden, if he becomes president, and Mitch McConnell, the senator from Kentucky who has been reelected, and he is the Senate majority leader. The business community actually likes that. We saw Wall Street enjoy the notion that there could be a Democrat in the White House, and Democrats often spend a lot of money on building infrastructure and maybe more stimulus to help the American economy in light of coronavirus. So Wall Street liked that. Okay, a Democrat, Joe Biden winning, as long as he's held back on the more progressive ideas, and it looked like the Republicans holding the Senate would hold him back. You know, it makes me think about, by the way, the Electoral College, the fact that we have 51 separate elections in the states and in Washington, D.C. Emily, as of now, what do you think about the effectiveness of that? There are so many people who say, hey, Joe Biden got more votes than Donald Trump. 4 years ago, Hillary Clinton got more votes than Donald Trump. And yet, it's the Electoral College, a complicated system where every state has its own rules as to how to count votes. and how to choose electors. Is that effective, or it's just something we have to live with?
Well, it looks for now like it's something we are going to live with, whether or not we should, because while Democrats have been clamoring, or some Democrats, I should say, have been clamoring to get rid of the Electoral College, it is highly unlikely that if Republicans keep the Senate, Democrats just aren't going to be able to do that. And out of the eight last elections, Democrats have won the popular vote seven times. But, you know, I was describing this to someone. That's like reading a storybook and looking at what the weather is and then using that to decide how you're going to dress when you get outside. Right? Like, it just doesn't matter. And yes, Joe Biden got the most votes of anyone and exceeded Obama, but that's not what matters. And I think that, you know, if there are certainly people in this country who would like to see it abolished, but I just don't think that that's going to happen in the near future. Does it seem like it's from a different time? Yes, it was designed by people who were born in the 1700s. Is it meant to reflect the plurality and diversity and the enfranchisement that we have in this country today? Again, no, because it comes from a time of white landowning men, but it is the system that we have. And I think, you know, it is important to remember that every election that Democrats and Republicans go into, you know, you go into it playing by the rules of the game that you have agreed to ahead of time. Because we still have the Electoral College, Democrats went into this knowing that they had to win the most electoral votes, just as Republicans did. Does that block a lot of what progressives would like to see Biden do? Yes, I think it's not just the Electoral College, obviously, but the system that we have, like the Senate and the Electoral College. And, you know, Republican senators have a majority now, even though they represent something like 14 or 15 million fewer people than Democrats do in the Senate. But again, that's the system as it is currently designed. And with a split government, that's the system that we're likely to have for the next two or four or and so on and so forth years.
Yes, there would have to be a change to the Constitution of the United States. It's not easy to amend the Constitution. You need super majorities, not just in Congress, but then in the state legislatures across the country. So we shouldn't expect the complicated electoral college system to change. And Josh Glancy, even though many people around the world are surprised and a little bit confused by the American system, you know, if you think about even the parliamentary system in your home country, the United Kingdom, who becomes prime minister? Someone who is the result of all the separate parliamentary constituencies around the country. Again, it's not a direct election for prime minister. So would you agree, Josh? Right? The world ought to understand. America has its system.
Yes. I mean, the American system clearly isn't perfect. Otherwise, we'd be sitting here with a president at this point. It is less democratic, obviously, to have an electoral college, and it's not what they call majoritarian. But it is what it is. And Emily points out that you go into the election knowing that, and you choose a candidate based on wanting to appeal to certain states and to win an electoral college victory, and you run a campaign accordingly. And that does mean people in certain states perhaps don't have their priorities heard and aren't as enfranchised as they might be and as empowered as they might be by the electoral process. That's a problem. And I think you could make an argument for change. But as you point out, Dan, that change requires an enormous majority and it's unlikely to happen. So rather than necessarily complaining about that system, people need to just work on winning within the parameters of the system they already have.
I just know that in the coming weeks here on Issues in the News, we'll talk about foreign policy and how America reacts with countries all around the world, with organizations like the United Nations, the NATO alliance, of course, the other major powers like Russia and China, the Middle East. All of that may change if Joe Biden is president rather than Donald Trump. Very big subject to think about, and I know that's in part why the world is watching what happens here as the votes have been counted even after Tuesday's election day. That's all the time we have for this edition of Issues in the News. Thanks to our panelists, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, and to Josh Glancy, Washington bureau chief for the British newspaper, The Sunday Times. This program is produced here in Washington, D.C. I'm Dan Ravitch.
VOA. the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, and welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA. I am Rick Pantaleo. Today, we'll examine and discuss the growing ecological issue of invasive species and the impact these invading pests can have on our way of life and precious ecosystems. According to an executive order signed in 1999 by then-President Bill Clinton, the United States defines an invasive species as, quote, an alien species whose introduction does or is likely to cause economic or environmental harm or harm to human health, end quote. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Invasive Species Information Center says that these invading life forms can be plants, animals, and other organisms like microbes. The Center for Invasive Species and Ecosystem Health at the University of Georgia's website says, quote, the estimated damage from invasive species worldwide totals more than $1.4 trillion, or 5% of the global economy, end quote. Joining us today via Skype is my guest, Don Weber, an invasive species expert and a research entomologist with the Agricultural Research Service of the USDA at the Invasive Insect Biocontrol and Behavior Lab in Beltsville, Maryland. Don, what are invasive species and how much of a problem are they around the world? In other words, why should we be concerned about this issue?
Invasive species are really organisms that spread in new non-native habitats. They can be anything, animal, vegetable, insects, mollusks, vertebrates, plants, microbes, including viruses, and altogether, they're a big deal. The estimated global impact, and this is just from invasive insects alone, is estimated to exceed $70 billion U.S. dollars a year in lost goods and services, and $7 billion a year in increased health costs, and some of that's from insects that vector disease.
So we're basically talking about invasive plants, insects, sea life, reptiles, and animals, pretty much all life forms.
Yes, all life forms can be invasive, and it's basically defined as new, non-native organisms in new environments. And in terms of human interests, it's defined as ones that jeopardize public health, agriculture, or natural habitats, and as a result of that, often have big economic impacts on humans around the world.
Are these forms of life also considered to be invasive in their home areas? And what differentiates...
Many of them aren't. And that's an interesting thing, and it also sometimes makes it a little harder to foresee what might happen when they get into a new environment. An example that I've worked on is the brown marmorated stink bug. Well, in East Asia, it's noticeable. It's kind of considered a minor pest, not a huge problem. When it was accidentally introduced to North America and later to Europe and even the Caucasus area, the brown marmorated stink bug didn't have any of its natural enemies, which is one of the things suppressing it in the native Asian range. And suddenly it was a much bigger pest. So some are and some aren't. Some we don't even know where they came from originally. So an example of one that is a pest in its native area is a very big impact now in Africa and Asia. It's called the fall armyworm. And in the Americas, where it's native, it is considered a major pest of maize or corn. So there's no set rule, but often it's less a problem in the native area where it came from.
Don, can you tell me the difference between an invasive species and a nuisance species?
Well, that involves kind of related to my answer to the previous question, which some native species are nuisances. For example, there are areas where the mosquitoes are native and they bite humans and they transmit disease and pathogens to humans. And that's an example of that. Basically, there are also exotic or non-native insects and other organisms which are planted, for instance, as crops or maybe as ornamental plants or enjoyed as pets, and they don't end up being invasive, meaning that they don't move into natural habitats and they don't threaten the native flora and fauna. So when we speak of invasive species, it's what's non-native that's bothering us. Just like a weed is a plant in the wrong place, an invasive species is more of a general term for something that's established and moved in and has negative impacts in its new habitats.
Are all non-native species, other words, exotic plant or animal life, considered to be invasive?
No, that's definitely not true. And in fact, the best example is our crop plants. For instance, the tomato, which is native to the Americas, and for that matter, the potato, which is fairly closely related to tomato, has spread throughout the world as both of them, essential and very tasty crop plants. And they do not tend to be invasive. So it's more of a judgment of what's the impact. In this case, non-native plants have a very beneficial impact on people's agricultural productivity and nutrition.
Don, how long has this been an issue? How long has invasive species been a problem for those of us on planet Earth? And is it getting better or worse?
Well, I think we could say it dates from probably the beginning of history, or at least the beginning of when people started moving around a lot, moving plants and animals, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally. Certainly one of the biggest early examples is the movement of European people to the Americas and bringing a lot of their own human diseases and infecting, unfortunately, those Native Americans who had not been previously exposed to them. So it dates back centuries at least. Of course, we have to put this in a bigger context, like we do evolution. We say, you know, this is species have been invading new habitats, even new continents over the course of millennia. What's happened recently because of a lot of human movement is that the whole process has sped up, and therefore the ability of the natural environment to adjust to those invasions has been degraded because these invasions happen so quickly. And sometimes groups of invasive species work, it happens together to aggravate or accentuate the impacts of others. There's examples, though, and I'll give one. The cattle egret, which is this white bird that you often see perched on the backs of grazing animals, originally from Africa, within recent history, and a big storm brought some of them over to South America, where they became established and, in fact, spread even to North America. And they're not considered harmful. So in answer to your question, it's more a matter of quantity, and it's increased so much, though, in recent years. And especially with air travel and world trade, there's an added number of what we call pathways of invasion that make it much more both abundant and impactful.
Don, let's examine those pathways. I'm curious, how do these species get to areas where they become a problem? Are they because of an accidental incident, or could it be someone's idea of treating another problem?
Well, there's examples both of accidental and purposeful introductions. Along the ways of accidental introductions, we think of the movement of live plants, produce, wood packaging materials, bulk materials like stones and other construction materials, tires, including old tires, people, their pets, and livestock. So it's a broad variety of pathways. Many times quarantine or preventative approaches to try and prevent spread of invasive species are targeted against some of the most likely. And some of those are live plants, wood packaging material, and people themselves bringing things on purpose. So you mentioned on purpose, the pet trade, unfortunately, is responsible for some, not the pet trade itself, but people who have pets, maybe some of the pet trade, but introducing naively, I think, not necessarily intending for harm to come, but thinking, wow, this would be great to have geckos on this island. And all of a sudden, you've got, you know, several thousand geckos instead of the two that started it. So nowadays, now in the past, there have been some intentional introductions in connection with what people hope would be biological control and controlling a pest that was already there. And one of the most notorious examples of this was introduction of the cane toad from South America into Australia to control some beetle grubs in sugarcane. Well, it was a dumb idea then, and it's a way dumber idea now. And biological control, when we talk about introduction biocontrol of natural enemies, is nowadays done very carefully. So it's screened for negative effects. And if anything's not specific and going to go to another organism that is a natural enemy, potentially attacking a non-target or beneficial or crop organism, that's not allowed. So it's a variety of accidental, purposeful pathways.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. If you have access to the Internet, please check out our Facebook and Twitter pages at Carol Castiel VOA for alerts and program updates. Let's get back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Today, we're examining the growing ecological issue of invasive species and the impact these invading pests can have on our way of life and our precious ecosystems. Don Weber, who joins me today via Skype, is my guest. Don is an invasive species expert and a research entomologist with the Agricultural Research Service of the USDA at the Invasive Insect Biocontrol and Behavior Lab in Beltsville, Maryland. Don, let's talk about some of the more troublesome invasive species and where they're causing problems. Colombia has a problem with an aggressive hippo population, and the hippopotamus is native to sub-Saharan Africa. How did they become an issue in South America?
Well, that's a kind of a unique story. The hippopotami, plural of hippopotamus, that now are in Colombia, South America, they were originally part of an illegal zoo by the drug lord Pablo Escobar. And when he was killed years ago in a firefight with the government agents there, he left this zoo, and the four hippopotami that were in the zoo were not taken into captivity. They were allowed to go free. And there are now, as I understand it, about 80 or maybe more now in that river basin, which is the Magdalena, Rio Magdalena in Colombia. And the issue is twofold, really. One is people who live in sub-Saharan Africa are very well aware of this, that the hippopotamus is actually the animal responsible for the most human deaths by large predators, not lions, elephants, etc. So they're a dangerous animal when they're mature. And maybe more important in terms of the impact on the whole ecosystem, they graze a huge amount of vegetation, and then their waste in the river can promote blue-green algae, what is sometimes called red tide when it's in the marine system, but an excess of nutrients that could be really damaging to the river ecosystem, including fish and other resources that people use. So, yeah, the people maybe laugh about the hippopotamus and Pablo Escobar's former zoo, but it's kind of a spectacular example of invasive species that were brought in, I guess you could say, as part of the pet trade. Some people are fond of them, but people with experience with hippopotamus in Africa say, don't be fond of them. Keep your distance.
This is a species that you had spoke about a little earlier, the fall army worm. It's native to the Americas, and I understand that this worm has recently become a source of havoc in Africa and Asia. Tell us a little more about this insect and how it got to non-native territory and what kind of problems it's causing in Africa and Asia.
Well, yeah, it's become a near global pest in the course of only about 5 years. It's a very strong flying migratory moth. And of course, the stage, the caterpillar or worm, fall army worm, that does the damage is the one that eats maize and many other crops. It's native to South America, Central America, and parts of North America. In fact, in the past, I've worked on that pest in northeastern United States on maize, sweet corn, actually. But recently, around 2015, it showed up in West Africa. And right away, people knew it was an issue because it's the major pest of maize in Central and South America. and feeds very heavily on the what we call the whorl stage, or before the tassels come out of the corn, and therefore has a big impact on yield. And then within a couple years, it spread to South Asia and East Asia. So India and China and Nepal and other countries in that region are now dealing with it. So a fall armyworm, you know, is a huge threat to productivity of maize, which is a major staple, of course, but other crops as well. So there are a number of, it's established. There's no way to really prevent it is established in Africa and Asia. The big concern is there are a lot of subsistence farmers and low-income farmers who cannot afford to treat it with pesticides or with Bacillus thuringiensis, which is BTE, a very specific microbial control, but that costs money. And there are a number of academic research, overseas aid agencies working with the countries around the impacted area to try and figure out what's the best approach to manage this now, because we're in a management phase. We cannot prevent what's happened. It's not known, as far as I know, how it reached Africa, but it could have been a natural introduction, but however it reached it, it's going to have a huge impact.
Don, another species that you spoke about a little earlier, I want to get a little more information on it because you have an interesting story about it. The brown marmorated stink bug. It's native to East Asia, but has been introduced to North America, Europe, and now Chile and the Georgia Republic. What is it? How is it thought to have spread from non-native areas? And what kind of calamity is it causing as an invasive species?
Well, the brown marmorated stink bug, and marmor is Latin for marbled, so it has kind of a marbled or mottled appearance. That's why it's called that. It's what we entomologists call a true bug. True bugs insert their mouth parts and piercing, sucking-type mouth parts. They don't chew. And in doing that, they can damage crops or inject their saliva, which is can be toxic to the crops. And also they're withdrawing food from the crop, so that's decreasing its productivity. Unfortunately, brown marmorated stink bug, which is native to East Asia, has a very, very wide range of host plants. I believe the list is up to several hundred. And it also has a somewhat like a nuisance value or nuisance status. When they overwinter, they like to overwinter in nature in rocks or hollow trees. And our houses apparently look like that. So buildings, including houses and other buildings, shelter these insects in pretty large numbers. And sometimes they get into materials that then might be moved, like pipes, tiles, et cetera, construction materials. And that's probably the way they were transported to both to North America and to Europe. They initially showed up in Switzerland. So brown marmorated stink bug is mainly looking like its most serious impact on crops is with fruits and nuts. You mentioned the invasion into Georgia, and in the Georgian Republic is a major source of hazelnuts. And I believe it's either the second or third leading producer in the world. And those were heavily impacted when the brown marmorated stink bug was accidentally introduced into that region. Chile as well, you know, grows a lot of fruits. That's a big concern. That introduction apparently came from the west coast of North America. So one thing you got to know about invasive species is once they get around the world, sometimes they can be introduced from a place where they're already invading. They're not a native. And the reason might be that, in fact, for instance, on the west coast of the United States, they're much more abundant than they are, for instance, in their original native China, Japan, and Korea. So it's an interesting phenomenon we call in entomology world, we call it the bridgehead effect. So some gathering of invasive species at a high level of abundance, like we see it when many times in the first several years when they're moving in, can carry on to other regions. And in this case, it has. Georgia apparently got its infestation from Europe and Chile from North America.
Don, I understand there's an interesting story about how European starlings became a real problem here in the U.S. Can you tell us about this and how extensive the damage is being caused by them?
Well, a starling is one of a set of birds mentioned in the works of Shakespeare. And I mention that because that's the reason it was introduced to the United States back in the 19th century, well over 100 years ago. There was a group of people who admired William Shakespeare and his writings, and they decided naively that it would be nice to introduce all the birds mentioned in Shakespeare. So they set about introducing, among other things, the European starling. And they tried very hard. They introduced it to Central Park several times. And we find this ironic today because it succeeded getting established in huge numbers. Its impact largely is on native birds here in North America, where the starling will take away the cavities where it nests in old trees, in the holes in fence posts and so on. And it really drives out the native birds, including woodpeckers that are considered beneficial in terms of eating beetles, that mainly beetles that bother forest trees. So the starling is established. It's fairly abundant in Europe. Another case where it's considered in some ways in Europe somewhat of a pest. It also loves to eat fruit when it's ripe. So fruit growers are not particularly fond of starlings. So that's a great example of a purposeful introduction. We wouldn't really recognize the purpose as a good one, but somebody thought it was a good idea.
Don, I was surprised to read that the common rabbit is an invasive species that spread from Europe and North Africa to all the continents of the world except for Antarctica. I always thought rabbits were a natural species everywhere.
Well, the most spectacular of that actually is a continent you didn't mention, which is Australia. And Australia, of course, was, after the Aborigines were established there, the Europeans showed up and they wanted their favorite animals from jolly old England and other places where they came from. And they brought, among other things, rabbits. And you think to yourself, well, what harm could a rabbit do? Well, if a rabbit eats all the vegetation in sight and furthermore reproduces very well, and rabbits are notorious for that, reproducing and making a lot more rabbits. So in that case, they brought along none of their native diseases or predators, and the predators in Australia were not familiar with rabbits and didn't have much impact on them. So basically, the rabbits denuded the landscape. And finally, that was an example of a spectacular biological control where they introduced a virus that quelled the rabbits. Now, that's not the only place that rabbits have gone and done some damage. In fact, I think there's a case now where they're present in the UK, and those were introduced in historical time from Europe. And people argue about whether or not they really have a place in that ecosystem. But yes, harmless things can cause harm on occasion.
And the one species I really want to talk about with you is, I understand, is responsible for wrecking ecosystems in the Florida Everglades, the Burmese python. Tell me how this snake, I understand they can grow up to 7 meters, how it became an invasive species, what damage it's doing in Florida, and what's being done to eliminate the problem.
Well, the Burmese python was kept by a number of people in Florida as a pet, and they also were kept by pet dealers as well. And as you know, Florida is subject to hurricanes, cyclones from time to time. So all those factors, including people's lack of awareness of how bad an idea it would be to release them, resulted in them being released in Peninsula or South Florida. And some were purposeful, but I think the evidence is also that they also escaped accidentally when people's houses and pet stores were ravaged during a number of hurricanes. But the story becomes then that the Burmese python basically ate up anything that was smaller than them. And as you reference, when you're 7 meters, there's most things are smaller than you. And they have cleared out a lot of the vertebrate fauna of South Florida, including raccoons, even alligators, and other predators. And it's still an open problem and a big one. They held a contest to see if they could hunt them down. There are so many, it's difficult. They're looking at attractants, and they're learning more about the Burmese python by tracking it. In other words, tagging snakes with radio collars or radio chips. And there is some hope that they can learn enough about what attracts them, because they're basically solitary except when they mate, but somehow they've got to find one another. And many times with animals, including insects and vertebrates, that involves what we call pheromones. Pheromones are odors that are produced by an individual to typically attract members of the same species. And those can be very useful in both detecting and helping to manage invasive species. Let me talk about weeds, common ragweed in Europe. It's amazing, though, that that is an example of an accidental natural enemy. The ragweed leaf beetle came in, and it's already been documented that that introduction, which was accidental into France, has reduced the ragweed. And in fact, opened the eyes of some in Europe to the fact that biological control can be a very effective method if it's carefully vetted and carefully carried out to specifically address the invasive species, in this case, common ragweed, that produces a lot of problems for people with allergies.
Don, we're just about out of time, but I want to ask you finally, what can everyday people do to stem the spread of invasive species?
Well, it's not all bad news, and I think when you learn more about this, there's several important points here. I think public education and awareness to understand that there are inherent threats to try and avoid introductions, and also the public has a very important role in recognizing and reporting these promptly so they can either be eradicated or addressed as early as possible, because the monitoring and inspection, anything that relates to preventative approaches, and if the potential invader is present, to a rapid response, is much better and in the long run less impact than if they become established and then have to be managed and there's going to be impacts. An important thing that is less apparent to the public is research with international cooperation. So we need to know what are the potential invasive species and the ones that are already there. We need to understand their biology, what they eat, what eats them, etc. We also need to get clues from where they're native and other places where they may have invaded. How do you manage them? How do you control them? Sometimes that involves looking at the natural enemies and potentially introducing them to suppress the invasive population. And it really is something we're all in together as a planet. As you alluded to at the beginning, we need to cooperate in learning about and managing these invasive species and to try and slow their spread in such a way that we can manage them and minimize the impact on our agriculture, our health, and our natural ecosystems.
Don Weber, I want to thank you so much for taking time to bring us up to date. Tell us all about invasive species.
Well, you're welcome, Rick, and it's been a real pleasure talking with you.
That was Don Weber, an invasive species expert and a research entomologist with the Agricultural Research Service of the USDA at the Invasive Insect Biocontrol and Behavior Lab in Beltsville, Maryland. He joined our program today via Skype. This is Rick Pantaleo. Thanks for listening today, and be sure to join Carol Castiel again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is the